It's January the 16th, 2015, and you're listening to We the People. And this program on the United States Constitution today will be dealing with a topic in which we've briefly dealt with before here at 1180 AM WFYL on this very program, and we're going to go in-depth with it today. And the topic is the necessary and proper clause in the Convention of States. And today on the program, we're going to have Gary Porter, Executive Director of the Constitution Leadership Initiative, Sam Rohr, President of the Pennsylvania Pastors Network and the American Pastors Network, and Charles Proctor, the law firm of Proctor and Lindsay. I'm Bruce Stocking.
And I'm Corinne Lillis.
And we welcome you once again to another fast hour in radio, another edition of We the People. And which the Convention of States is something that has come into discussion more and more, considering the way things have been going with the current administration and with the Congress itself, both having tremendously low approval ratings. People are beginning to wake up and realize the fact that this is a government, a representative government that, well, begin questioning, are they actually representing we the people, in which a representative government was designed to be a point where we elect people to be our representatives so we can continue to operate our stores, our shops, our businesses, and not all having to go down to the legislative in Washington and speak as a whole as a democracy would have. And this is why we're a representative government. And the idea of the Constitution itself, of course, and it's stated in the first three words, we the people. It's our document. It's not a document of the elected representatives. It's the people, and it's all about. And to get us going on this discussion is Gary Porter. And, of course, Gary last Saturday was up here in Pennsylvania teaching a Constitution seminar, which was just an outstanding seminar in itself. A full day of information, some said, that I've talked to said it was just amazing the information that's out there, and they've learned so much for it. And then, of course, afterwards, Gary did a little extracurricular activity where he began talking about with the Convention of States and that. But let's bring him on now. Good morning, Gary. You made it back to Yorktown without a problem.
We did indeed, and I'm still on a high from last Saturday, I'll tell you. That was an amazing event. I am so glad I did it. I'm so glad you guys took up the challenge that I threw down there. And so glad that it came off as well as it did. It was a perfect day and a wonderful day of talking about this wonderful Constitution.
Oh, absolutely. And no better place to do it than here in the Philadelphia area where the Constitution of the United States took form and birth, and to bring it back in a discussion education mode for people to understand. It was just marvelous. In fact, one comment I did notice at the end, when you open it for any comments, there was one voice that rang out clear, when are we doing it again? So it was very good. But Gary, you did afterwards have a little, like I call it, an extracurricular activity that dealt with the Convention of States. And, of course, today that's our topic, the necessary and proper clause and the Convention of States. So why don't you lead us off?
Well, you're right. I did that at the end, and I wanted to make sure that only those who are truly interested in discussing that topic stayed behind. And, well, it was the end of a long day, and a lot of people had other things on their schedules, so I wanted to give them a chance to bug out if they wanted to. But it's an incredibly important subject, and I think that we need to be talking about it. The conservatives in this country who are trying to get us back to constitutional government should be talking about it. And unfortunately, there has been a polarization that has taken place, and so I characterized last Saturday's extracurricular activity by saying, you know, be careful how you talk about this with folks, because there are some hard set opinions about this, and you could easily turn someone off and stop the discussion that needs to be carried out. So I sent this essay out last night to my whole mailing list, and I've gotten some replies already this morning about from people saying, I don't want to ever hear about this again. My mind's made up. But others said, yes, we really need to be talking about this, and it was a well-written essay, and these are important topics. So let's go ahead and talk about it. The idea, the focus of the essay was, what is the role, if any, of the necessary and proper clause in this whole discussion? And those who are opposed to a convention typically say that Congress is going to use the necessary and proper clause to expand their power in this area beyond just calling for a convention as required by Article 5 when two-thirds of the states apply for same. And they contend that Congress will use the necessary and proper clause to not only set the date and the place, but also to set the conditions that will take place within the convention. That is, they will set up the rules for the convention's procedure. May even try to set up how delegates are selected and how many delegates each state will be allowed to send. And so I contend that the necessary proper clause, certainly if you look at the history of that clause in the way the Supreme Court has interpreted it, you could come to that conclusion easily, yes. Mm-hmm. Since McCulloch v. Maryland, when John Marshall said that items don't have to be absolutely necessary to qualify under that clause, then the court has taken the position that when combined with other clauses, like the Commerce Clause, this is an immense expansion of Congress's power, or Congress can immensely expand their power through the combination of the necessary and proper clause and other wide, loosely interpreted clauses like the Commerce Clause. Mm-hmm. So, yes, the potential is there, but I focus on whether this Congress, this 114th Congress, would in fact try to do that. And I conclude that they will not. I concluded that with Republican and conservative majorities in both houses, that this Congress would not make that attempt. But if they did, if they tried to set the conditions for the convention and even control how the states select their delegates, that the states should use and should rightfully use their nullification powers to push back against that.
Well, Gary, if I could jump in here with that one, you know, you're mentioning the fact with Congress probably won't go through there. Of course, question one would be what Congress would. You know, it's quite literally the idea, even with getting them to vote themselves into doing term limits, that's almost a mission impossible itself. Now, with the states, being that the states themselves have, as you were pointing out a little bit last Saturday, willingly given up those powers that they have, besides what the Constitution says that the states cede a small portion of their authority, but they've given up more, and things such as the 17th Amendment in there, would the states step up?
Well, you rightfully point out that the 17th Amendment changed the whole paradigm. That changed the whole balance of power in the federal government. But once that cat was out of the bag, it actually pushed the states more into using nullification, because once they've lost their direct voice in the Senate, as was originally intended, then it forces them to take other remedies. And nullification has unfortunately risen more to the forefront. But it is a rather limited strategy. As I pointed out in the seminar, there are some very significant limits to nullification. And if I can take just another minute, I'll point them out very quickly.
Please.
Nullification is, of course, a single-issue action. You can only nullify a particular federal law. So it's one law by one law. You must nullify each in turn. And so how many onerous federal laws are there? Thousands. And so if we're going to really use nullification, we've got our work cut out for us. And secondly, a nullification action can be reversed by the next state legislature that comes into power. So there's nothing permanent about it. And a nullification action doesn't do anything to the underlying federal law. The federal law still exists. It still affects other states that have chosen not to nullify it. So it is a very piecemeal, very limited remedy, and I don't see it as the panacea that many who claim nullification is the panacea to be.
Okay.
How often, I'm curious, I don't know if anyone knows a specific answer for this, how often have states gone through the nullification process?
Well, there's an easy way to find out. There's an organization called the 10th Amendment Center, and they have a website, and you can find it, and they keep track of the state's nullification efforts. So I don't know the direct answer to your question, Corinne, but I do know that it is, you can locate that information. Now, states have nullified various and sundry things. Some states have nullified potential legislation. How's that? They've said if the Congress ever passes anything that negates the Second Amendment, then it'll be null and void in our state. So they've used nullification in advance of some of the actions of the Congress in some cases. But there have been attempts to nullify Obamacare. There have been attempts to nullify gun control legislation. The list is quite varied, but it is also quite varied. I mean, different states have taken approaches to this.
Now, Sam, I know you have some thoughts on this one. Why don't you weigh on in?
Bruce, some thoughts. Hi, Gary. Welcome this morning.
You want to say
I'm being mild, dear.
Yeah, I'm busy writing down notes here Gary.
I miss sitting beside you there.
Yeah, boy, yeah, we miss having you as well. It was good to be together on Saturday. But, you know, like our founders did, they argued things in, because there were good reasons to argue. I'm gonna take some argument here with some of the premise you've laid out, if you could, Gary, because I'll just say, at the end of the day, I mean, where I'm coming from is I don't think it's a good idea yet, but and I'll explain a little bit perhaps why that is here. But it seems to me that in the layout of the premise you've put here, you're making an assumption that a majority House and Senate in Washington, being the Republican hands, is gives you good confidence that they will do the right thing. I think that's an assumption, number one. Number two, the other thing is that you know, the fear that Congress will, of some who oppose the convention, fear that Congress will just seek to get more authority. I agree with you. I don't necessarily think that will be something that they will want to do by convention. So I don't factor that in, and agreeing with you on that, I don't think that's a major concern. Because at the end of the day, they've been garnering authority because, as we've just talked about, the states have given it up. And so why do they need to try and get actually more on the books? Because they're not following their own rules and regulations anyways and not fulfilling their duties vis-a-vis the executive branch and so forth. Now, my sense, and there's a couple of things. I'll just raise one question here at this point. Number one, the fact that Congress is now a majority House and Senate under normal conditions should mean that the fear that many people have would be lessened. I don't think we're there yet. It may prove to be itself, but I don't think it's there yet. I would like to see this Congress that if, in fact, they have any interest in this convention and for calling it under any fashion, calling it with no restrictions, calling it with some restrictions, however it would be, but if they just open the door for that they first manifest in first order here in this first term, this year coming up, that they are in fact going to do what they already can do but have been failing to do under the last many sessions of Congress. They've not passed budgets. All right, let's see what happens when they pass budget. We saw what they did, although they weren't in majority control at the end of the year when they passed a budget way ahead, taking away the power from this currently seating Congress to do so, as we saw them do. That wasn't reflective of this new body. But nonetheless, they have options now of how they're going to treat Obamacare. They have options of how they're going to treat an executive branch that has been violating the Constitution repeatedly. They have the opportunity to deal with things in a budget which they have not been dealing with under the previous scenario. I would like to see from the perspective of performance, if the intents are true and if there is to be a working relationship between the states and Congress, let this Congress, now sitting in its current form, do what they can do without any change to any Constitution. Let them do what they're supposed to do and manifest that, in fact, they are, in fact, going to lead according with the current powers as they already have it. That's what I'd like to put out there first, and just say I'll just stop with that point at the moment.
Okay. Well, let me go over to Chuck. Chuck, your thoughts on this matter.
Well, Bruce, I want to jump back to something Gary said earlier. And by the way, good morning, Gary. It was great seeing you last week. I really enjoyed it. And my wife, who, of course, we talk about this all the time, she said she got so much out of it, and it put some other things in perspective that we've been talking about over the years because of the detail and in that short time as well that you had that you put forth. So I thank you for that. That was really great. But I want to jump back to something that you said about the 17th Amendment. If you look at the last sentence of Article 5, it says that no state without its consent shall be deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate. Now, the minute we passed the 17th Amendment, equal suffrage went out the window. And everybody thinks, well, you still have two senators. No, we still have a Republican and a Democratic senator. If you look at the Pennsylvania state legislature, which would have appointed our senators, we'd have two Republican senators. And we would have had two Republican senators for quite some time. Sam would know the actual numbers there. And I think that that is indicative of the contradiction that, for example, the 17th Amendment and several others have created and causes some of the confusion about whether we should have a constitutional convention. And I'm still a little bit torn. I see your point. I see Sam's point. My concern in this environment, in this political and social environment that we see today, is that a convention of that sort without some serious forethought as to who's attending and who they're representing and the issues that are going to be presented could become a distraction and not get anything done. And that distraction would then further limit the ability to have conventions in the future. And I think that a lot of work needs to be done rather than just saying, oh, we're going to have one.
Well, I agree with you entirely about the equal suffrage issue. And for that matter, the 17th needs to be repealed. So that brings us to the question of how do you intend to do that? Senator Zell Miller famously tried for years to get a resolution on the floor of the Senate to repeal the 17th, and unsuccessfully so. The Congress will never repeal the 17th on their own volition. It will never happen. I mean, there are certain things I think we have to accept. That is never going to happen on the volition of Congress. It is only going to happen if the people demand it, and the avenue that I think they have available to them to demand it is through a convention of the states. But that aside, your point about rules and regulations, now, that certainly has been foreseen, and there are the Convention of the States Project has been meeting with other groups to try to come up with those rules in advance, rules that everyone can agree to and rules that we know will produce a safe and constrained event. I would be very hesitant about supporting just the idea of a convention of the states without some forethought put into the rules and the chance to examine those rules and, you know, put those rules to the American people, and let's make sure that we all agree that those will produce a safe and constrained and limited event like we all hope it would. So I agree with both your points, and I think that there's work going on underway right now to come up with some rules that we can examine and we can subscribe to or demand be changed.
Okay, Gary, this brings up a question as well. Is, yes, it does come down to we the people pushing the initiative through, but we have to then revert to and rely on and pressure our representatives to do the will of the people. And then, of course, you have the chief executive of the land, the current one who is a fan of executive orders, and now he's got a veto pen, participation in there. These are roadblocks that we, the people, would have to overcome. How would that happen?
Well, as I pointed out Saturday, everybody needs to be involved, and much more so than they have been historically, in this representative government we had. As Franklin said, a republic, if you can keep it, requires that we do some care and feeding of this republic, which we have unfortunately historically not done, and therefore things have gotten out of control and out of hand. So definitely the people need to get involved, and they need to be sitting down across the table with their representatives, not firing off emails that never get answered, but demanding a personal audience with their representatives and expressing their concerns to them face-to-face. That definitely needs to happen. If more of that happened, if more of that had happened over the years, we wouldn't be in the fix we're in.
Well, true, but we're also dealing with the fact, too, that these representatives, really, when you look at it and they've got a track history, let's just say over the past 6 years, that what they're representing in all appearance seems to be themselves and their political future versus the people that put them in those very offices. You know, they're all public servants. They have fallen extremely short of serving that public. And thus, again, we have that roadblock to overcome, and sitting with them, fine. But can we get enough of them together to get on the same page, to understand the gravity of this thing, to push forward and to at least get the gears going to make it happen?
Bruce, I would be willing to do one of those all-day seminars every single Saturday of the week if I could find groups like WFYL willing to sponsor it. But that's exactly what needs to happen. We need to be having those seminars and those classes like IOTC is conducting every day of the week. There is an immense population that needs to be educated, and unfortunately there's no coherent plan to do so. It's guys like me and organizations like IOTC that are doing what we can, but we're not in a coordinated sense doing this across the nation, and it needs to be done across the nation.
Well, thank you for your thoughts, Gary. We're going to head to a quick commercial break here, but I want to remind our listeners that they're listening to We the People here on 1180 AM, WFYL, licensed in King of Prussia, Philadelphia. We have to head to a quick Fox and commercial break. We'll be right back. Stay tuned for more.
We the People of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. All right, thank you for sticking with us through the break there. You're listening to We the People, and I am Bruce Stocking.
I'm Corinne Lillis.
And we are joined today on our panel with Gary Porter, the Executive Director of the Constitution Leadership Initiative, Sam Rohr, President of the Pennsylvania Pastors Network and the American Pastors Network, and Charles Proctor, the Law Office of Proctor and Lindsay. And when we went to the break, and today's conversation, of course, is the Necessary and Proper Clause and the Convention of States. And in our conversation about a convention of states, we got into talking about nullification, and which there's a lot of opinions here on the panel on the convention of states and with the nullification. And I kind of want to pick up where we left off and kind of go to you, Sam, with thoughts and notes that you have been putting down on this and what we were just talking about.
Okay, I'll be glad to do that. I think, Gary, I think as you've laid out, we just talked about in the earlier part, obviously the concern that all of us would have would be that we have a federal government, a Congress, and so forth, that has exceeded their authority and need to be reined in. I mean, so at the end of the day, now you've put down a couple of things in what you've laid out there, for instance, as far as the purpose, imposing fiscal restraints, limiting the power and jurisdiction of the federal government, and term limits. Now, obviously, I think that you probably put that down there as examples of what could be, but I've often heard that those are the primary things. But nonetheless, most of the things that I've been hearing about as a primary reason is to try and force the federal government to live within its means, not spend more than it has, and so forth. A lot of it deals around with the fiscal issue. And I want to tie that in with the nullification thing, because really it's this convention that seems to be something that the outside, someone outside Congress, can bring to bear to force some discipline on them that they ought to be manifesting anyways by the mere fact that they have sworn to uphold their oath and do their job in Congress. The other is the nullification piece of the equation. And I know that you put some things forward relative to why it would be construed to be ineffective and where it has been done, hasn't really made any difference and so forth. I would submit that really it hasn't been done effectively except a couple of times way back in time. There's not been anything recent really to compare it against. And I would say that my sense would be this. We look, as you're looking, we're looking and saying, well, we've got a majority Republican House and Senate now in Washington. Therefore, that should give everybody a greater sense of confidence and hope that a further consolidation of power won't be, and that there will be a willingness to give back some of what has been ceded to them. On the other hand, there are also more Republican-controlled legislatures and Republican governorships than there have been before also. And if we were to believe that the states are going to have what it takes to make sure that the convention runs well and does right when they gather, then I would submit, should we not also think and expect that the states, even a handful, even two or three governors and legislatures, were to agree on a single thing, issue, whatever it be? And I would say the primary thing, if they were to do this, it would force a change that would send shockwaves through the system. And that is if they would stand and say together, we will not implement certain items. For instance, we will not implement Obamacare as an example, or we will not take any more federal education funds. We're going to do our own thing because it's a state issue. It's not a national issue. If a couple of the states themselves were to say, we're going to cut those strings and we're going to do our thing to free us up, because right now, I mean, I know because I've been there. I mean, the reason the states roll over and have ceded power to Washington is because Washington's promised them money. And they have taken the money and they have voluntarily given up their rights. So I would say until that issue of voluntary bondage, let's put it that way, voluntary bondage by the states is addressed, I do not believe that the states are going to voluntarily take and do something else to put manners on Congress, because it's not Congress that took away their right or their authority. It's they themselves who are giving it up, not just in the past, but at the moment. I would like to see some coordination with, and I believe that it could be more effectively done, more quickly done, and it would, in fact, set up a shockwave that would go through the system if you'd have a couple states alone. One could do it, but you'd have a couple states that would say, we will not do it. We are saying together, we will not take your money. We will not implement even one major, major issue like an Obamacare. And they could do it, and it would send shockwaves through the system, and it would force Congress to act, and probably may at that point give Congress the guts to take and do what they ought to do, and that is instead of revising or reforming, in this case of health care, they actually would repeal that whole thing altogether, which right now this Republican Congress is not prepared to do. So that's I'd put that thought out on the table and say that nullification, I think, is more powerful than we think. It's not been effectively done, and that even if without the nullification process, if the governors or the states, a couple of them, just said, we will not, whether they call it nullification or not, we will not take the money and we will not do that, it'll force the kind of change that moves forward this debate in a way I think we could find more realistically whether or not there's that support there for it and see what happens. Put that on the table.
Well, Gary, before I throw it over to you, we have on the phone right now David Whitney has joined us in the conversation. He's a pastor and senior instructor of the Institute on the Constitution. Good morning, David, and welcome to the program again.
Good morning. No, Oh, thank you, and I agree with what Sam's saying. Nullification has really not been tried, and that should be the first thing that is done, and it can be done without having to get to, you know, 37 states together to all agree to do this. One state can do it, or two states, and begin the charge. The other factor that I would want us to consider in all of this is that we're told that the states will be able to stay in control of the convention. And I would say there's one problem with that. The states thought they were in control of the convention that met in Philadelphia, 1787, because they each sent, all 12 states that sent delegates, instructed their delegates that the only thing they were to do was to revise the Articles of Confederation. Well, obviously, they didn't revise the Articles of Confederation. They proposed an entirely new constitution, and I would argue a convention called at this point in time could do exactly the same thing. Once it met, it's a convention of the whole. Once it met, it's free to propose an entirely new constitution and legally do so. English history shows us that there's several conventions that have met, one of which, of course, is the one in Philadelphia. And each of those conventions, when they met, employed a mechanism to change the government in an enormous way. And I would argue that that would be exactly what's available to those delegates who gather. They cannot be controlled by the states once they meet in convention. And I would argue, therefore, that what they did in Philadelphia in 1787 was legal. In other words, even though their states told them the only thing you could do is revise the Articles of Confederation, when they met, they had the power to actually propose a brand new constitution. I would argue that any convention that we call at this point in time would have the same power to do a new constitution if they choose to do so, and would not be restricted by what the states have commissioned them to do specifically. So that's my part of the argument that I just wanted to get in this morning.
Okay, Gary?
Yeah, well, thanks for bringing that up, David, because it does point out a misconception. There were seven states that had issued the instructions to their delegates and appointed their delegates long before February of 1787, when Congress got around to recommending that the remaining states also support the idea. And if you look at the instructions that those delegates went to Philadelphia under, I'll read Virginia's here. Virginia's delegation was authorized to assemble in convention at Philadelphia as above recommended and join with them, the other delegates, in devising and discussing all such alterations and further provisions as may be necessary to render the federal constitution adequate to the exigencies of the Union. Well, that's a little bit broader than revising the Articles of Confederation. They were entitled and empowered to do what was necessary to change the federal constitution and make it adequate to the exigencies of the Union. And seven other states followed Virginia's lead almost verbatim in their instructions as well. So there were only a couple of states, Massachusetts and New York, and one other perhaps, that included the words revising the Articles of Confederation in their instructions to their delegates. So in only three cases, perhaps, were delegates constrained to revision only. And if you recall, New York's delegation left the convention when it became clear that the convention was proposing an entirely new document, and that to remain, New York's delegation felt, would cause them to violate their instructions. So they left. Yates and Lansing left together on the 3rd of July, and Alexander Hamilton left a week later. So I think that the delegates in Philadelphia in 1787, the majority of them certainly, were vastly more empowered than we give them credit for, if you look at the instructions that they went to the convention with. And then it would be the same today. We have to very carefully examine the instructions that the delegates are sent to a convention under. Sam pointed out that there were some limitations that I placed on a convention. Those were not my limitations. Those are verbatim out of the Convention of the States Project Protocol. And if 34 states, as the COS project proposes. If 34 states submit identically worded applications that say we are only going to support a convention that is limited to these three topics, then that is the kind of convention that I support, and the only convention that I support. The problem is a lot of people conflate all sorts of different ideas for a convention into one little lump sum here, and they say then, therefore, that there can be no safety. But I think there can be safety if 34 states agree that this is what they are going to support and only what they will support.
Well, let's look a little bit more into the legality end of it, and so a little discussion we had at the break. And, Chuck, I want to bring you in on this one. We had talked about some of the hurdles that are that we'd be faced on this thing. And then, of course, you have the other hurdle. When you got into things like nullification, where I don't think in all the attempts that have been done on any form of nullification that have ever gone through, because they've been smacked down in courts.
Bruce, you're absolutely right. We can go all the way back to 1809 in United States versus Peters, where Pennsylvania legislature tried to strike down a Supreme Court ruling, and it went so far as Pennsylvania, the governor called out the Pennsylvania militia, and the U.S. Marshal's Office sent in a posse, and eventually they backed down, and the law was the Supreme Court ruling was upheld. And some comments were made by, and I have a quote here. I looked it up while we were talking. 11 states told Pennsylvania, "Hey, we disagree with what you're doing." And James Madison said that this was a if the legislature of the several states may it will annul the judgments of the courts of the United States and destroy the rights acquired under those judgments, the Constitution itself has become a solemn mockery, and the nation is deprived of the matters of enforcing its laws by the instrumentality of its own tribunals, which is a pretty strong statement about the sovereignty of the state to use nullification. So first of all, we have to educate legislators, attorneys, and judges about the power of nullification through the basic concept of sovereignty. And until we do that, I don't think we're going to get anywhere, whether it's through nullification or whether it's through a convention of the states.
Now, Chuck, let me ask you this. With even a convention of states, you know there'd be some that immediately go to challenge that in federal court. Would there not be?
Oh, absolutely. And as we were discussing during the break, Bruce, you cannot expect a federal judge today to know everything about every aspect of the law. You would think that they would understand some of these constitutional principles, and I'm not knocking the judges, no disrespect, but there's just too much out there. There was an article in December about this Congress failed to achieve the status of having passed the lowest number of bills in recent history, 298. Well, multiply that by 10 years, and that's 3,000 bills, and on ad infinitum. And yet, with that proliferation of bills and with the number of things that a judge has to deal with, you find them getting specialized in certain areas. And so the system, you may or may not end up with a judge that understands these concepts, that even knows what nullification is, that has even heard of the Constitution of the states or a convention of the states. And as I mentioned in the Hobby Lobby case, when we first filed, the judge called us up and said, "I have two problems. I'm going on vacation, and I know nothing about this case, about this law."
Yeah.
I mean, that's a quote. He said, and he was very nice about it. He said, "So you guys are going to have to educate me," which is what our job is, but he knew nothing about the HHS mandate.
Yeah, yeah. So, well, David, I'm sure you have some thoughts along that line as well.
Let me just back up, if I could, a bit, to and I appreciate Gary speaking about the language that the states would need to craft to keep their delegates in line, and that's all well and good. However, if we go back to the language of the seven states that he's referring to, that language referred to the Articles of Confederation. When it spoke of the Federal Constitution was the Articles of Confederation. So they all knew they were talking about the Articles of Confederation. Revising that document is what they meant when they put in their instructions the federal constitution. They weren't referring to the constitution we currently have. They were referring to the Articles of Confederation. So again, it's a risky thing in my view if we entrust this body that once it's formed together would seem to have powers, and obviously they took those powers in Philadelphia in 1787, have powers to create a brand new constitution. Now, of course, that constitution would then have to be ratified by the states in order for it to become law. But consider what took place in that ratification process. There was a breakup of the United States of America. There was a breakup as nine states joined the new union under a new constitution, and four states were outside of that union. Two of those states quickly joined the union, but there was a year and a half period of time where we had two countries, the union under the new constitution and the union with North Carolina and Rhode Island under the old constitution. And, you know, I think it's a risky thing to go down this road, because we are going to empower these delegates from English history as well as American history with the potential of creating a whole new constitution and essentially the breakup of our constitutional republic.
Well, gentlemen, we also had almost a total breakup of the country on a constitutional matter that happened in 1861, and it took till 1865 to bring it together, with more American lives being lost there than any war before or after combined. So, we have constitution issues there. Of course, it's going to bring in conflict. And so, Gary, why don't you start bringing us around the corner on this one for today?
Well, let's look at it from another angle. This is part of the Constitution. Article 5 is part of the Constitution. It was specifically given to us for precisely the circumstance we find ourselves in today, where Congress has become an obstacle and an obstruction to good constitutional government. So this is a tool, a proper tool, that the founders have given us. And it's just like the carpenter who goes to the house project without his saw. You know, he's purposely limiting himself from a proper tool that should be in his toolkit. And he's going to find, when he gets to that job, that he may be lacking the tool that he should have carried with him. So, yes, there are concerns. Yes, this needs to be approached very cautiously. But I think that a lot of good men have put their thoughts into this, and that if 34 states, who definitely by their numbers will control a convention, go into this thing saying, we are only going to consider proposed amendments that meet this criteria, if 34 states can be found to say that and mean it, I think that we can have a safe convention and we can get around the obstructionist Congress that we're faced with.
Sam?
Well, you know, that's true to some extent, you know, but I still bear down on the fact of saying an option of this type does bring with it unknowns. We've been talking about it. The encouraging of a governor or state or two to approach together a particular item under the nullification of process, or whether they call it that or not, just say we refuse to implement such and such a law and we're not going to take any more federal money. That doesn't have with it any risk. That bears with it just a matter of an exhibition of commitment and courage and duty on a part of a couple of states. I think that bears with it no risk. It has enough. It will have an effect that will demonstrate courage. It'll demonstrate that there are some states and some governors who understand the concept of sovereignty, understand the concept that they have in their position of authority, can push back against authority in Washington, which has been given over. And that doesn't require any change to any law or the Constitution. And I feel if I and my sense is that if they fail to do that, then I'm not certain that what the states will send to a convention will have my confidence, in fact, that they will do the right thing, which is what Dave's talking about. So, Gary, I would say, what's the downside? What's the downside of taking that other route, saying we've got now lots of more Republican governors and states who are very clearly talking very loudly about what the impact of the federal government is. What is wrong with raising this up as a matter of purposeful strategy and saying, who will stand up among you? We need a couple of leaders and work behind the scenes and then publicly to have that be done. Do you not think that would have a significant effect and would be a downside, no risk, and perhaps even quicker?
Sam, I go back to my toolkit metaphor. I think it is a proper tool. And Bruce, what I would propose is that next week we talk about nullification, and we go into that in much more detail. We look at the history and the current state of nullification that we find ourselves in. Let's flesh this out a little bit more. But the bottom line is, it is a tool. It is one of many tools that we have, and I certainly support that your proposal that a couple states stand up and act in a unified manner like this.
Exactly, and I agree with you with next week's topic being on nullification. This is when you came across with the Convention of the States as the topic for today's program. I knew this wasn't going to be a one-shot thing that we're going to have to do too. And so the nullification end of it, absolutely. Let's put that on the agenda for next Friday.
I'm sure David would be willing to join us.
Oh yes, and David, if you can.
Yes, I'll plan to join because I think one of the essential things in the topic of nullification is giving the states the power to say no, as Sam's recommending. We know exactly why they'll say, "Oh, we can't do that. It's money," and follow the money trail and get back to the constitutional means of taxing is really the key, I think, to allowing states to say yes to nullification. But we'll talk about that next Friday.
Indeed. Chuck, your thoughts on it?
Well, Bruce, the thing that concerns me, and I think this is some of what Sam is saying, is that we have an electorate out there, and we have elected officials that need the type of education that David and Gary are trying to provide to the country, because it's not being provided in our public schools. It's not being provided in our universities. It's not being provided in our law schools. And that type of education, I think, is fundamental, because whoever goes to that convention, or if nullification is proposed, needs to understand the basic concepts that we talk about on this show, that Gary talked about last week, and people like David and Gary, in their attempts, and they're doing great, wonderful things, there needs to be more of that. Without that, I share Sam's concern that we're going to have people that completely misunderstand not only the process, but the intent and where we're going with it, and use it for other various and sundry means. I know some of the functions that I attend, and I see people with what I call the individual agendas that they're trying to advance, and I just see that getting in the way without solid education saying, hey, look, if we can change the 17th Amendment, if we can get that undone, look at what a difference that's going to make. I'll call it a deal breaker and yet a starter at the same time. It's going to be a deal breaker, and it's going to break up the current system, and it'll be a starter for a new way of approaching the problems that we have. And I think that's our first thing we have to do.
Yeah, I agree, and I think we're going to have to leave it at that point. For next week, our next week's topic, we're going to continue this discussion, and we're going to focus on the nullification of laws and various other things with the Constitution. And again, gentlemen, this has been another fast-paced hour. Great discussion, and I look forward to next weekend's discussion. We've had Gary Porter, Executive Director of the Constitution Leadership Initiative, Sam Rohr, President of the Pennsylvania Pastors Network and the American Pastors Network, Charles Proctor, Law Office of Proctor and Lindsay, David Whitney, Pastor and Senior Instructor in the Institute on the Constitution. I'd like to thank also Corinne Lillis, my co-host. And
Bruce, I want to encourage our listeners to stay tuned for Carla's show coming up right now at 8. She interviews Dr. Joe Horton. He's with Vision and Values. He's a Grove City professor, and it's Sanctity of Life Month, you know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So stay tuned for that interview. If not, you can catch this show and her show as well as our other shows on the podcast page on 1180WFYL.com.
That's it. And I'm Bruce Stocking for We the People on the United States Constitution. Thanks for listening. We look forward to seeing you next Friday. And since the weekend is at hand, go out there. It's going to be winter, like, you know, temperature-wise, but it's not going to be too bad. go out there and do some stuff with your family this weekend. Let's put the electronic devices aside and let's communicate with one another and let's take back our country and take ownership once again of our Constitution and the United States. God bless you all and have a good weekend.